I'm the co-founder of an organization, an action research center, which is called GovLab, Governance Laboratory. And so we specifically focus on how do we improve people's lives by changing how we govern using new tools and new technologies. And we start from the premise that we try to test throughout all our work, that technology really has given us access to two important assets in society that we can leverage in one way or another towards improving the way we go about solving problems, designing public services, or making public policy. And those two assets that we focus on are, on the one hand, people. So we do a lot of work around collective intelligence, crowdsourcing, citizen science, new ways of actually engaging citizens around quite often their expertise, because we feel like expertise, and especially expertise of citizens, is quite often a supply side of solutions in society that is largely ignored and or mismatched with the demand side in society. And so we try to figure out how can we actually match the demand with the supply of expertise and, of course, engagement that might be there. And then the other asset, which I will focus on today, but happy to go in any direction that you feel is interesting, is of course data. And so the last few years, we've tried to understand how can we leverage data in a manner that really informs how we go about making decisions in the public interest towards changing the way we govern and towards improving public services, improving public policies, improving the way we go about solving problems. And specifically, while we've done a lot of work on data science and leveraging data and data science, specifically, we came to the conclusion that we really have to focus on how do we unlock the asset in order then to start using it, creating knowledge, and then how do we then go from knowledge to action? So from unlocking data to its knowledge, and from knowledge to action, and this end-to-end kind of approach to data for good is something that we have focused on. And so we've done a lot of work initially around open data, open government data. The co-founder of GovLab is Beth Novak, and she was behind the first executive directive by Obama, which led to the creation of open data. And so we leveraged that legacy somewhat, and of course have done a lot of work around open government data. If you're interested, we have a website where all our work on open data resides, which is odimpact.org, where we really try to understand what is the impact if you open up data. We have 39 detailed case studies, and based upon that, we have developed a methodology to really leverage data in a manner that maximizes impact on people's lives. And the methodology is something that we call the periodic table of open data. So if you're interested in a new periodic table and then try to understand the elements of open data, you can find that on OD Impact. Now, through our work around open data, but also through some of the work that I've done in my past life, at a certain point in time, I was head of research of a private foundation in New York. And we did a lot of work around unlocking health information. And so throughout a lot of that work, but also open data, we came to the realization, of course, that data assets in society are widely distributed, and that there is one actor in society that is emerging as a very important actor in the data ecosystem, which was different in the past. In the past, clearly government had a certain dominance when it came to actually creating managing information. But what we see is, of course, that corporations are becoming more and more dominant data players. And what we try to understand is how can we also not just unlock open government or government assets, but how can we also unlock corporate data assets? And so that's where we started focusing on data collaboratives, and that's what I will try to focus on throughout the conversation today, trying to share some of the lessons that we have learned through our range of initiatives that we have established in the field of what we call data collaboratives. Now, just to start off, which is the rationale why we look at this, and I already indicated that we are really interested in making a difference in society. And of course, if there is one observation that we can make is that clearly we have plenty of challenges and problems in society that somehow, given the fact that we have, anyway, quite a lot of assets at our and resources quite often at our possession, somehow can't seem to solve. And so that's the first observation that we start with, which, by the way, means that we feel that we really have to come up with innovative solutions. But we not only have to come up with innovative solutions, we also have to be innovative in how we develop the solutions. And so that's the area that we focus on, which is not just coming up with innovative solutions, but also innovating in the way we develop solutions. And that's where, well, we believe data plays a role, because the second large observation, and again, nothing is new to this audience, is of course is that we are in a rapid period of datafication, by which we mean is that any kind of interaction leaves a certain data trail, and as a result, any kind of action that you engage throughout a day creates some kind of data about your behavior or about your intent or about others' behaviors as a result of being monitored. And so I have a whole, which I haven't shared because it freaks people out, a whole assessment of the data that is collected throughout your day. I mean, in the statistical agencies, they start to look into, and especially as it relates to administrative data, there's this whole assessment of from birth to death, right? And what are the important data records that you create throughout your life to a large extent, right? Starting from a birth certificate and then to, anyway, some degrees and that, and so on and so on. And that ultimately forms the whole field of administrative data. But we can actually do a similar kind of assessment from morning till evening and see that actually throughout the day now, we actually have a huge data trail. Whether you go and buy something, there is very likely a digital engagement. Whether you communicate, whether you move around, whether you consume media, whether you go to a physician, when you obtain an education, or just calling for Alexa to instigate a certain kind of action. And so there is a huge amount of data. And if we start thinking about who at those points are currently collecting data, then it turns out not to be government, right? And most likely corporations. So we have tons of personal data, but of course we also have made radical progress in data science, ranging from new methodologies like sentiment analysis to CDR analytics. A person from Orange probably has been looking into call detail records analysis to machine learning and so on and so on. Anyway, nothing new here. And so what we try to understand is that how do we innovate in how we come up with solutions by unlocking private data for public innovation? And we also realize that this cannot be done by demanding, although we can have a whole conversation about that, but it's very unlikely that it's going to happen by demanding corporations to open up their data asset. It's very likely that it's going to require some kind of a new partnership. And so data collaboratives, what we believe, is the new kind of public-private partnership for a data age, where you actually work with the demand side and the supply side of data to make sense in a manner that can innovate how we go about solving public problems. And that's where data collaboratives comes into play, where we believe that it's a much better way of actually matching demand and supply and also quite often a much more trusted way than if you would just unlock data, for instance. And we can, anyway, come back to that later. So what we've been doing, which is quite often what we typically do at GovLab, is to then scan the practice. And so we have, before we turn this into new research or turn this into experiments or turn this into methodologies, which is something that we do quite often. And so we initiated this project, which is called datacollaboratives.org. And so if you go to datacollaboratives.org, there you will find the largest repository of examples where corporations have worked with others around their data in order to generate insight that could be of public importance. And so at the moment, we have about 250 examples where corporations have leveraged their data for good. And what I will do next is basically share some of the analysis of those 250 examples. And by the way, we are still mining those examples and constantly updating, because this is an emergent field. And more importantly, it's an emergent field, which I will tell later, that many actors come, but also many actors go, right? We still have a problem, actually, of a field that is sustainable and systematic. Now, besides our focus, there is also, and we're delighted that that quite often is based upon some of the work that we have done, there's also an increased interest worldwide. For instance, the World Bank has now an international consortium for data collaboratives, where they try to set up collaborations with the private sector around the data in order to generate public interest. OECD, Paris 21, of course, I wrote a paper for OECD on leveraging corporate new data sources for statistical agencies. So statistical agencies are realizing that they have to enter the data age in addition to the statistical methods that they have and adopt new methods, but also have access to new sources. And so they are very interested in trying to figure out how to have access to data from corporations, which is also the mandate of an expert group that has been created by the European Commission that focuses on business to government data sharing. And so I'm on that expert group, and we've had so far about three plenary meetings. And other members are corporations such as Telefonica, BBVA, Deutsche Telekom, MasterCard. So a whole range of corporations that are really working with the European Commission right now to try to think what would be a model to have to share corporate data with government in order to become smarter about reality. And so we're going to release a report I think by September, coming out of this expert group. All right, so the first big finding is that, which is not unique to data collaboratives, but that data collaboratives quite often are used for four specific value propositions. And by the way, whenever I get asked by both corporate and public actors about what's the value of data, I always say it's very simplistic. There are four types of value propositions that data typically has, and corporate data, of course, serves that as well. In order to transform, especially if you focus on policymaking, transform the whole policy lifecycle, starting from agenda setting to ideation about what solution it would be, to implementation, to enforcement, to review, every element of the typical policy life cycle or governance cycle can be transformed or informed, because again, we don't have to overstate the potential impact, by corporate data in four ways. The first one is that data can provide better situational analysis, right? So you can actually become more aware of the reality of what's happening, of the situation. And more importantly, if you start using, for instance, call detail records, you have this phenomenon of nowcasting, which statistical agencies, just dream of, but have not yet been able to establish, which is that you actually have a sense of how the situation evolves in real time, right? Typically, statistical agencies only have a sense of how the situation was based upon disclosed information through surveys at a given time. But now casting is, of course, an emerging field. And again, you could say there are all kinds of challenges here, but that's the first value proposition. The second value proposition, which is then linked with knowledge creation, is that you don't just have a better sense of reality, you can also have a better sense on what explains reality. And so, which we call cause and effect kind of questions. And so now you can actually, especially if you start aggregating data, you can start becoming smarter about what variable explains the situation that we are in. And then from a policy point of view, actually focus on the root causes as opposed to the symptoms, which is what we typically do as it relates to public policymaking, is that we quite often focus on symptoms as opposed to really understanding what causes the symptoms that we have. So we become smarter into the diagnostic kind of field. The third one is around prediction, where we can, based upon patterns of the past, you can actually predict what might happen in the future. And then the fourth, typical value proposition of data and corporate data is around impact assessment, which is how you can assess the impact of an intervention in reality and then have a constant cycle of actually review, which leads to experimental governance. You cannot do experimental governance, so you cannot do evidence-based governance if you don't have the situation analysis, but you can also not do evidence-based governance or experimental governance if you don't have that constant cycle of actually assessment of the impact of certain kinds of interventions, right? And this is, we, for instance, hosted for a long time the Behavioral Insights team for the U.S., and so behavioral economics is basically constant experimentation based upon certain kinds of interventions in the choice architecture. And that's a data project, right? So, and again, nothing new probably. And now I need to, thanks Celine for giving me the password. So these are the four value approaches. Okay. Now that we know, and I can give you examples in a second on how this has happened, the question is, of course, now we know what the value proposition is, right? How do we go about this? And it turns out that there is no one way of actually going about setting up a data collaborative towards establishing the value. And so what we have analyzed, and we just finalized a more extensive report on operational models for data collaboration, there are like six big types. And the first one is, and again, in no order of importance here, the first one that we see a lot happening is where corporations are setting up prizes and challenges around their data. And so they say, okay, we have a distinctive data set and we want to open it up. Orange has done this, for instance, in Senegal and in Côte d'Ivoire, where, and again, there are all kinds of challenges which we can discuss, where they've opened up some data sets and said, whoever can come up with insights that really enrich the our understanding on what you can do with call detail records will get a prize, and then you can do the full research with full access quite often to the data that you might have. And so this was called the Data for Development Challenge. But many others have done this. BBVA, the Spanish bank, has done the same thing, where they said, we open up our data, a data set, and whoever can come up with insights that might help the unbanked will get a prize, right? And so this is a kind of data sharing, right? A kind of data collaboration. And of course, quite often, by the way, what I forgot to say, we put those data sharings on the notion of shades of openness and shades of collaboration. And so this is, a certain shade of openness of the data and a certain shade of collaboration where actually anyone get invited. In Senegal, the one that won a prize was by using call detail records to understand energy consumption in Senegal so that you actually have a better and almost real-time, just by looking at phone records, a real-time understanding of peaks of energy consumption, which they didn't have before. And so now actually energy policy can be informed in real time almost by actually using telephone records. And so that's one thing. We, anyway, I'm gonna come back to that in a second. So that's one model. Second model is of course the typical research partnership model. And so for instance, this is a one of our partners at MIT who have full access to Twitter feeds, not just the regular Twitter feeds, but anyway, the full Twitter feed. And so they've set up this laboratory for social machines. Some of you might know Deb Roy. And so that's a research partnership where they are really having access to Twitter. And so they've been looking into disinformation and how it spreads, which was their latest report. And that was a typical research partnership. The latest, another one that you know is probably Social Science One, is a research partnership that Facebook has set up together with the Social Science Research Council in the US and is funded by five foundations so that it becomes sustainable over time. And here they're gonna provide access to Facebook data, and they've just done the selection of who is going to have access, again, in order to understand election behavior, for instance, better. And that's like a typical research partnership. We have one of those with Telefonica in Santiago de Chile, where we have access to call detail records through our partners there, UDD, where we have access to call detail records. And what we've done there is we've leveraged the call detail records in order to understand mobility within Santiago de Chile from a gender perspective. Do women travel different than men within the city? Turns out mobility is gendered, but no one has really understood how gendered mobility is and why. And so we try to understand that, and suddenly you have the potential to actually have a gendered transportation policy. Because typically transportation policy has one kind of gender in mind as they are developing and where to plan bus stops and the like. So that's an example. The third example is then an example which is emerging more and more, and some of your data scientists in the room perhaps will be troubled by that. And here again, the shades of openness of the data is very limited because they don't share any data, but they share the insight of the data. And so what we see more and more is that corporations are setting up quite often research units within their own corporation and then sharing the data, the insights that they have, which is not to be underestimated, right? So you could say, well, it's not going far enough, right? And we could argue about that. But to a large extent, anyway, the insights, if you're a policymaker, the insights is what you're after, right? And so this is here an example, and again, all kinds of challenges, which we're gonna open up in the perhaps the discussion thing. But this is like JP Morgan, which is the largest bank in the US. And JP Morgan Chase has created a new institute, which is called the JP Morgan Institute, which is a what I call the emergence of a new kind of institute, which is called what we call data tanks, right? So these are not think tanks, but they are a kind of think tanks, but they use and have unique access to data. And by the way, we see the demise, another analysis that we are doing, we see the demise of think tanks because think tanks, by the way, talking about information asymmetries, think tanks don't have access to the data that JP Morgan has, for instance. And so JP Morgan is now and has now become one of the most important players as it relates to economic statistics, for instance, in the US. The reports they release have more insight than the statistical agencies can develop, for instance, as it relates to the gig economy, because they know exactly how much an Uber driver earns. They know exactly whether it is actually a livable wage, for instance, right? And so they, anyway, have access to that data and share some of the insights, which are fairly unique. And so there are many other ones, like Facebook, and quite often, what I have to say, there's multiple operational models, and corporations are experimenting with multiple operational models. So it's not because one corporation does one. Quite often corporations use different models at the same time. Facebook just released health maps, which is an overview of where certain prevalence of health conditions emerge. They also released population density maps in Africa, which Facebook has the best population density map in the world of Africa, much better than the statistical agencies have there or any UN agency has. And so they didn't share the data, but they shared the insight as such. And we can go back on why they have that population density. And that was clearly, anyway, for a business purpose, i.e. to increase connectivity. But they also decided to share it so that everyone can actually have access to the thing. And again, there are all kinds of societal questions here with regard to information asymmetries that, of course, are problematic. But I'm just listing what is happening in the space right now. And many more examples. Google, of course, has been sharing intelligence products for ages, right? Like even the Google Zeitgeist is in a kind of an intelligence product as well. Then, of course, you have what some data scientists might call nirvana, which is then the shade of openness is really open, but then quite often limited collaboration, right? Some corporations have provided technical means to have access to their data in a streamed manner. That doesn't mean they are unconditional, right? Because they have APIs, have conditions quite often attached to them. But this is, for instance, an example here of Zillow. Zillow is the largest real estate information broker in the US. If you want to buy a house, if you want to rent an apartment, you're going to have to go through Zillow to know what is the market price, right? And so what Zillow has done is they basically have provided an API to some of their data, which then has been tremendously important for city governments because they now have used that data to really understand gentrification and can actually, anyway, identify gentrification before anyway anyone else as a result of having access to the API of Zillow, for instance. And so an example, again, of a data collaborative where access to certain data was provided. And then the last one, actually there's one that I forget to list here, is the trusted intermediary. This is not the last one. And that's the where you have a anyway corporation say, we don't want to be burned with, because there is a lot of cost involved in responding to solicitations for data. And so especially if you're a small startup, is that we don't want to be burned by the reviewing the solicitations or with figuring out how to provide access to the data. We're going to use a trusted intermediary. And so that could be a corporation like Dahlberg, which is a trusted intermediary used by a lot of telecom operators. But it could also be a university. Like, for instance, Yale University is a trusted intermediary to clinical data from Johnson & Johnson. So Johnson & Johnson, the pharma company, has said we want to provide access to our clinical data, but we don't want to review or be part of the review of who wants to have access. We want Yale University to do that. And so they created something called Yoda, which is the trusted intermediary to do this. And then the last, which somehow the slide disappeared, the last model is the research repository, and that then quite often gets closely aligned with this notion of a commons, right, where different actors are donating sometimes or placing their data in a data pool, and again, there are multiple models there, or a data repository. The concept of data trust is becoming like trendy these days. That's a kind of a data repository with a kind of a governance structure, right? Data trust is more governance structure than actually an operational model, but that's another example. All right. So this is a little bit of an out of date, but still it gives you, and it's still reflected, it gives you a sense of the prevalence of the current operational models. And so data pooling and the research partnerships is what is most used. But we see, anyway, actually the intelligence product, we see a radical increase in that kind of behavior where they are starting the intelligence, but not the data. And again, there are all kinds of challenges. I've been calling that we then need a separate audit, basically, institution to be able to audit whether the insight actually is trustworthy from the data if you don't have access to the data, right? And so we need to have a new way of dealing with those things. And again, across domains, healthcare, of course, is quite prevalent, but we have many other ones. All right. Quite often when I, when I spoke with people about the type of work we do, and I said I'm looking into how corporations and are sharing the data, they always thought I was very naive. And I said, wait, why would they share the data, right? And it's a very good question, right? Because clearly more and more, right, the data is being provided as the differentiator in their industry, right? And the more we have that kind of narrative, the more it's going to be challenging actually for having a conversation with corporations about why they should share the data, which is their, their diamonds. And so we've tried to also understand what are the incentives and motivations for actually engaging in data collaboratives. And so here we came up with the seven R's of incentives. And it ranges, and again, I'm not going to go fully into details, but it ranges from reciprocity, i.e. I share something and then I have access to something, right? And so that reciprocity could be reciprocity to other data sets, but quite often is reciprocity to domain expertise, right? I work with UNICEF, for instance. We do a lot of work with UNICEF. And then we have access to actually experts in certain countries that we all would otherwise have no access to, right? And so it's that kind of reciprocity. Revenue, clearly, this is becoming a clear business. There is a clear business case now, and we see many corporations, especially telecom corporations, developing data services, right, and charging for the data service. And again, you could say, what we are talking about is quite often, and what, by the way, the European Commission is focused on, is quite often data collaborations with preferential cost structures, right? So where you actually don't have a corporate relationship, but clearly revenue, and for instance, for satellite operators, they might charge less, but they still charge. I mean, satellite operators, it's very hard to have free access to satellite streams. And so there's always, then they charge market cost, which is then, by the way, a new kind of fair access, right? So like to what extent, if it's for a research purpose, they have a different license than it's for another purpose. And so on and so on. So research and insight, quite often they get new insights by sharing the data. This is the open innovation model, right? If you share your asset, then you're going to actually get more value by others extracting value from your asset, and so on and so on. And then the last one I want to just highlight, which was kind of an interesting one that we identified, was retainment of talent, especially in corporations. Data scientists are becoming a critical asset. And if you are joining a certain corporations and the only task you have is to optimize advertising, those data scientists quite often feel underwhelmed with regard to how their talents are being used. And so more and more corporations are seeing data collaboration as a human resource strategy or part of the human resource strategy, where they actually can say, if you work with UNICEF, right, you see actually that the data scientists, if they can spend 20% on those data collaborations, there is a higher retainment of those data scientists within the corporation. And quite often it's a recruitment strategy as well, right? So you, A, you solve a big problem, and B, you have access to data you would otherwise never have, right? And so that's why, by the way, many researchers are moving to Facebook or others for that proposition, right? All right, there we go again. So these are a few findings with regard to what's the value, how is it being done, and for what, what's the business case? Now, clearly, there are tons of challenges, right? So, and so this is just one example of a challenge, and of course, again, Facebook is, I should have used another example because Facebook is such an easy example these days to get headlines. But that was the first ever backlash that a tech company had with regard to using their data for public for research. And so this is the famous Cornell study, where Facebook had set up a research partnership with Cornell University in order to understand contagions of moods. And they actually intervened in messages where you would have these are more or less kind of moody messages, and they tried to understand is there a contagion of certain kinds of moods. And that, of course, created all kinds of uproar, because Cornell had, because they were confused. They typically would go through a review board to do that kind of research, but because it was a corporation, they didn't go to the review board. And so there were all kinds of ethical questions here. But it's a clear example that there are a whole ton of ethical questions associated with actually using corporate data for good. And so it's like a summary of some of the challenges. One is, of course, privacy and security. And I could go at length on, and you all, looking at your introductions here, you're all pretty sophisticated in understanding what those risks might be. But also challenges with regard to generalizability and data quality, right? And that's, where statistical agencies are banging their head against the wall. If they work with corporations, how do they know, I'm gonna have to speed up, how do they know whether the data is representative, right? Because it's data of their customers, and not everyone might be a customer. And as a result, what we call, you have data invisibles, right? It's kind of very interesting. Typically, the narrative quite often was around overburden of data collection. But if you're not in the data, and data is being used for policymaking, you have a problem as well, right? And so, and typically those data invisibles were already socially excluded. And as a result, if you start using this data without recalibration, of course you can recalibrate some of that, will you actually only have insight in a certain strata of society and ignore that strata? Data quality and so on. Cultural challenges, which are quite often challenges within the corporation. I always make the joke is that I have not met that many people that were promoted because they shared data, right? So it is data hoarding is still the cultural norm, right, in corporation. And so it's a cultural shock quite often for them to really start thinking this through. And of course, competitive concerns, which is real, right? If you start sharing data, to what extent then my competitor have access to the data as well, and how will that go about? So all this leads to my observation that this is not easy to do, and that we really, if we care about this, right, we're going to have to become A, more systematic, and we're going to have to develop new methodologies of doing this, which we don't have at the moment. We're going to be more sustainable, because most of the examples in our 250-plus repository are one-off examples, right? So these are all pilots, and they're all prototypes. But none have, well, except for a few, have scaled to actually, a service that is there in the long term. So, and the reason why is because it's quite often unsustainable, right? There is a cost involved, and they have not thought through how do you make this actually sustainable. And of course, it has to be responsible. And so the mission and what we are focusing right now at GovLab, in addition to the research, of course, is how do you make data collaboratives systematic, sustainable, and responsible, right? Because these are the three elements that you need to have to make data collaboratives, right? More responsible, more systematic, and more sustainable. And so we do this in a variety of ways. And the first one is that the reason why it's not systematic is because we actually are lacking a profession. And the profession that we're currently lacking in corporations, but also in the public sector, is the profession of data stewards, which are individuals that really have an understanding of what is the data asset and what could be the public value of the data asset. At the moment, I mean, if people knock on our door and says, we want to work with Corporation X, quite often they say, good luck finding the person you have to talk to, right? Because there is no designated function within the corporation that really can do this data stewardship role. And as we already said, it's actually complicated. So you need to have someone who can really spend their time on thinking this through before it can become systematic. And so what we are building is actually a network of data stewards. And so at the moment, we have like 60 corporations that have joined our network, where they really start thinking through what would be a new profession look like. And that's not the chief data officer, because the chief data officer has different KPIs. They want to, anyway, grow the business. It could be, anyway, joined with the data. And it's also not the chief privacy officer, because they clearly, anyway, are all about risk mitigation, not about public value creation. And so that's what we are working on in order to make it more systematic. And we do all kinds of profiles and case studies to understand what is actually the role of a data steward as well. And frankly, having a data steward might also deal with some of the ethical components if you make the data steward ethically responsible, right? And then it becomes a professional norm as opposed to just a policy, right? The second thing we are doing towards making it more systematic and sustainable is related. So the first one was related with the supply side and what we call professionalizing the supply side. The second one is about the demand side, meaning we've done a lot of data collaboratives and have studied a few, and I became kind of, and done a lot of open data work, I've become quite frustrated with sometimes the marginal insights that are generated, right? So, and the reason why that is quite often is because they start with the data, right? And say, let's see what we can find with the data without really having a well-formulated question that matters. And it says, if we would be able to answer that question, we would actually make progress. And so so we're starting the 100 Questions Initiative, which is like the first ever initiative with regard to data and data science, where we want to map what are the 100 questions that matter that data and data science could answer if we find a way to do this responsibly and sustainably. And we're going to do this across 10 domains. One is, for instance, migration, which we just started last week, where we build communities of bilinguals, which is another profession, by the way, or another kind of individual that has emerged. And bilinguals are people that have a domain expertise, but also a data expertise. And quite often, they are the ones that know what are the issues that matter for the domain that can be addressed by data. Because too often, we have data scientists, they have no clue what the domain, anyway, what is important. Or we have domain experts, and they either think everything can be answered by data, or have no clue what could be answered. And so we're building those communities of bilinguals. So we have we've reached out to 150 in the migration space. Anyway, 50 have said yes, anyway, so far. Anyway, we've not reached the deadline. But 50 already have said yes, count us in. And then we're going to basically source and then make that publicly available and have a public discussion about those questions, right? So that would also become safe. Anyway, that's just one example to strengthen the signal, which, by the way, is something what governments ask, because the biggest transaction cost for corporations quite often is to assess whether, A, the partner is trustworthy, and B, the problem is worth opening the data assets for. And so this is another one. And then another one is, of course, related with understanding the value. We are, and again, I would love to hear whether I'm wrong, but we have very poor methodologies to assess value of data. We actually, anyway, have not yet developed the science quite often to develop value of data. And so what we are trying to do is develop a new methodology. We developed a canvas to assess the societal value of data. And in this context, in New York City, where we call it circular city data. So what is the societal value of, for instance, Internet of Things being collected in order to allow autonomous vehicles to move around New York City? But what would be, anyway, how can you use that data or other societal challenges, right? And that methodology is what we're trying to develop so that you actually have a sense of the potential value and, more importantly, because that's quite often the risk, you also have a sense what is the risk and the ethical obligation of sharing data, right? And so what is the risk of not sharing data? Because too often the discussion is about the risk of sharing data, but if you have an understanding of the societal value of data, you could also have a conversation about what is the moral ethical obligation to actually share the data if you know that X amount of lives could be saved, if you know that air quality could be radically improved and as a result 100,000 people would have, anyway, would be prevented of having asthma attacks, for instance, and that kind of stuff. So if we cannot quantify or illustrate the public value, then we also have a kind of a narrow discussion about the risks, which is then my next thing. And so here is another methodology that we've developed, which is a risk assessment methodology across the data lifecycle, right? Because too often the focus is on data sharing and not on the risk of data collection, right? And why was it collected in the first place, to then ultimately using, because you could have, anyway, be very ethical and have no bias in your algorithms, but still have the wrong parties using the data, right, or the insights, especially if you are, anyway, in certain countries that might be conflict-ridden, for instance. If you start using data from CDRs to inform emergency relief, and then it turns out that this insight is also being used by conflicting parties, then suddenly they have much better intelligence to target their thing. And so instead of benefiting, you harming individuals as well, right? And then an example towards also that end. So we're starting this contracts for data collaboration, because in order to minimize the risk, quite often contracts or information sharing agreements is the tool that companies use, and is also quite often the reason why data collaboratives are never formed, right? I mean, I always say that you could have a wonderful dating process among parties that want to share, but then if the lawyers arrive, then quite often the initiative stops, right? And quite often that is because they don't understand how to write a particular data sharing contract, or what should be the components. And so we are building this repository of data sharing agreements, and then based upon that, we are building what we call here the wheel, the contractual wheel for data collaboration, which is basically demystifying the way of setting up information sharing agreements around some specific questions. So that's in a nutshell, meaning just to give you a flavor around data collaboratives, what is emerging right now? What are the issues associated with that? And as you can see, if the center is interested in that, there are at least 5 big research agendas in this space, if you're interested, that needs to be developed in order to really become smarter about corporate data assets and how to start using that when appropriate and when responsible as such. Those who are interested in this and also interested in what GovLab is interested in, every week we select 20 new developments or new findings, and that's the livinglib.org where you can subscribe. So that's it. And I went way over time, so you should. Any reactions?